going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. We are Thursday, April 6th, 2017, and we are in order here.
Chandler.
So we're going to be having a public hearing today on a number of bills that are all related to the extent that they all deal with the proper use of land. And so I'm going to be opening them all concurrently, and we will be hearing about them and have an opportunity for people to speak to them. And so we've asked people to sign up for and against all of them, but realizing that some of you may really be for some or against others, that's fine. Just tell us what you think. So with that, I'm going to open our public hearing on Senate Bills 432, 602, 608, 612, and 618. And I'm going to ask Senators Knope and Ferrioli to come up together. Yes. And so, Senator Knope, since you're the benefactor of the majority of these, you want to start?
Well, thank you, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Tim Knope, Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And I am before you today with four bills that deal with land use. And the summary of all the bills starts with allows local governments. And so these are essentially freeing up local government to do some things that I think they need to have the power to do. So many of you know that in my private life, I work for the Central Oregon Builders Association as their executive. And I also work with two different affordable housing nonprofits. And what I can tell you is that dirt inside the urban growth boundary is incredibly expensive, and dirt outside the urban growth boundary is not as expensive. And yet, it's the same dirt. It doesn't look any different, doesn't feel any different. And so Senate Bill 602 allows the local government's planning for employment sites required by state land use goals to waive those requirements of the goals to establish and maintain a five-year supply of shovel-ready employment sites. So one of the things that is important about land use is, you know, it basically does a couple of very important things. Obviously, it allows for people to buy or rent property. Ideally, if we are following land use law and there's a 20-year supply available, the markets typically work well. But when we get below a certain level and supply is constricted, demand is high, like it is in Bend and Portland and some other areas, it necessarily causes land prices to skyrocket and therefore rents to skyrocket because choices are few. And so that's what's currently happening in the Bend market today. So 602 would it really empowers local governments to maintain at least a five-year supply of shovel-ready job sites to ensure steady development and job creation opportunities, which is critically important. One barrier to job creation is that land use is the land use and development process that lasts too long and sometimes is too complicated for people to work their way through, and they essentially give up on what they're doing because it just doesn't make financial sense when you have the time value of money there. So we need to make it easier for local governments to create jobs and hopefully not hinder them. Excuse me. And then one of the Oregon Business Plan identified needs is to move beyond Senate Bill 100 and really update it and require jurisdictions to maintain that supply of developable land. While jurisdictions can have vacant industrial land available, many of the sites are not ready for development, and that's critical. that sites are ready for development, because we compete in a significant national landscape now with multiple states who are recruiting businesses from Oregon, recruiting the same businesses that Oregon and Central Oregon are trying to recruit. And so that's basically what Senate Bill 602 does. Senate Bill 608 allows local governments to expand the urban growth boundary when the number of new households in a jurisdiction exceeds the new housing units within a jurisdiction and the vacancy rates drop below 6%. The vacancy rate currently in Central Oregon is less than 1%. And so it basically on any given day, there are between 5 and 20 units that may be available. So it is very difficult for somebody to be able to rent in this particular market. And of course, that affects the employment as well. And so Oregon's soaring rent prices and housing shortages are caused by some of the inflexibilities of our land use system that limits essentially building homes and apartments in a short period of time. And so we can't respond quickly to that need. And so when there's less of a supply available, it's going to cause that demand to go up. So due to housing shortages, we all know that rents throughout Oregon are rising faster than income levels, which is hurting many low and middle income families. For example, just according to Zillow valuations, the average rent prices in Bend, for example, are $355 a month higher than the national average. In Gresham, they're $342 a month higher. And in Portland, as I'm sure you know, they're about $479 a month higher than the national average. So we've had less new construction in the past decade. So a lot of that has to do with the Great Recession. But in Bend, we've been working for the past decade on expanding our urban growth boundary. And you know, have finally gotten to the point where we're going to add a couple thousand acres. But the demand is so great because we've been underbuilding for a long time. The supply and demand chain is one of the biggest impacts on Oregon's housing affordability. So we're not talking about getting rid of Oregon land use laws. Really what we're doing is we're talking about modernizing those land use laws to work for people of Oregon today. And we need to make sure that we allow more houses and apartments to be built so that that supply does exceed the demand and rents fall. And I know there's there's another measure out there, Senate Bill 2004, but that's actually going to make the problem worse, because rental owners need to get a specific return on that investment. If they're not going to do that, there are other investments that will return those investments will do that, and they're going to move out of the housing market. I mean, I didn't realize how many landlords I had in the district until that bill, and it seems like everybody's a landlord apparently, because the emails I'm getting is you know we're retired and we have two, and we're retired and we have four, and I only have one, and this is going to impact me so significantly. And what 2004 does is it's just responding to the symptom. What we need to do is get to the underlying problem and try to resolve it. And so that's what these bills that I've proposed are attempting to do. So Senate Bill 612 authorizes local governments with sustained high unemployment in their population or population decline or high poverty to waive state land use regulations for a project that will create five or more new full-time jobs at 400% of the federal poverty level. So for a family of four, that's $98,400. And so really the goal is, and I've talked about this a fair amount, is that we need to have better paying jobs with benefits in Oregon. And so we need to essentially incent that to happen. And so this is one of the ways to do that. And I think Senator Farioli's bill probably mirrors this bill. I think this is the one where we are very similar in what we have. And then Senate Bill 618 just simply allows local governments to waive land use regulations to address a land use emergency. And so this provision would sunset in 2023. But the importance of this is really to allow a in an emergency a quicker opportunity for the local governments to try to resolve the issues before they get so severe, like they are in Portland and Bend and other places in the state. And we've been underbuilding in Oregon for about 10 years now, and we need to get back to a steady market. And we're getting there, but we still have a shortage. And there's huge demand, and there's always demand, even during the downturn. It was surprising in Bend. There was still demand. It was just, it wasn't at 7% growth a year. It was 1% or 2% growth per year. But there was still demand, but there was no building going on. So the difference between, let's call it the peak and the valley, in the city of Bend, there was about 2,000 permits, single-family permits, on an annual basis at the peak. At the valley, which happened for a while, it got down to 150 permits on an annual basis. And so a 95% decrease, and sales kind of track that as well. I mean, sales went down substantially. And so, and that's just not new housing, that's just all housing. And so when you have a 95% decrease, and we had that for multiple years, it hovered, you know, it kind of went from 150 to 175, and, you know, but it was essentially underbuilding the market for multiple years in a row, but the demand was still out there, and so those foreclosures were getting scooped up. And then ultimately, when people were able to build again, and building started to take off about 2012 again, we're still behind, and we're not catching up. And so I just think we need to give the local governments some of the tools that they need to be able to manage this process in a better way. And so I would be happy to answer any questions. I do need to get back to the district. So if I excuse myself before you testify, Senator, I apologize for that. But if you do have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Farioli, let's go ahead and hear from
you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members of the committee, I feel as perennial as a daffodil here at your committee. I think this is probably the fifth time this bill has been introduced in various sessions of the legislature. Senate Bill 432 would allow rural communities who have a population of less than 50,000 and which have experienced no population growth, zero, to develop their own land use plans in the usual and customary way, but without complying with the statewide land use planning goals. In other words, they could opt out not of land use planning. They would still have to go through the land use planning process at the local level, just not to have to comply with the very difficult and complex land use goals that are attached to the 19 land use planning goals. We've limited eligibility to communities of Baker, Gillum, Grant, Harney, Malheur, Sherman, Wallowa, and Wheeler counties. Those counties comprise a significant portion of Oregon's land mass. But in all those counties, the total population is less than 73,000 people. So in other words, in all of the counties that I mentioned, we have a population of less than the city of Grants Pass. All of those communities, six of the eight, have lost significant population over the past 10 years. This is causing disconnections between the community and its ability to cover basic services like 911 services. Or hospital districts. Certainly, there's a double effect on the schools. As families move away, we lose their participation in the community. We lose the jobs that they once occupied, but we also lose the a share of school funding through the ADMW because kids leave. So our schools and our community infrastructure, the social infrastructure is what's really becoming unraveled in those communities. The way to combat that, of course, would be to attract new businesses and young families. A side effect of the exodus of folks from those communities is that our population is getting older on average, and it actually is ending up needing more services that the community itself cannot pay for, which means that folks fall into a safety net. We're actually exporting money from urban areas to support community services in rural areas because the communities are not sustaining themselves. I've watched this over a 20-year period, and it's just really becoming exacerbated. As ranching families age and they have no heirs that want to continue in the ranching business or farming, very often what happens is those properties will either be sold to an environmental organization, which puts conservation easements up, so we lose the production from that land. Also, we lose the tax base. And then further, if they are sold, usually it's to vertically integrated corporations. So we have a larger and larger land ownership being concentrated in smaller and smaller groups of people. We're losing the family farms and ranches. Those effects can be combated, but we really need to be able to give the local decision makers some flexibility in how they can attract new opportunities for employment and new residents to those communities. You have the bill before you. It's a relatively straightforward bill. It's modeled on a very successful legislation that occurred in Washington State in 1990. Washington State recognized that their Growth Management Act wasn't a good fit for all counties, that the central planning model may work in a highly urbanized area, but it doesn't work very well when your population and your infrastructure is dispersed over such a wide area. So in their wisdom, the Washington State Legislature passed an act that allowed the small counties to opt out of the GMA planning requirements, which are similar to Oregon's LCDC land use. In the many years, in roughly 30-some years that that has been in effect, those 10 counties have actually been able to sustain their economic base and grow population. So those counties, in fact, in comparison to Oregon counties, are thriving. They have not experienced devastating abuses of land use because the folks that administer those programs are all locally elected officials. They are responsive to their communities, and I think no one in a community wants to see their community lose a viability or livability. So those issues still play out in amongst the local governments. These communities have been asked to provide some case studies, and I've provided those for the committee members, but I'll just highlight a couple that I think are interesting. In Ontario, which should be a thriving community, there was a company called Treasure Valley Renewable Resources that wanted to locate there, and it was a company that would produce ethanol and biofuels. It was a biorefinery, and it ultimately couldn't absorb the cost of trying to get through the permitting process to locate the biorefinery there in Ontario. Even though it had the support of the Regional Solutions Program, the county commissioners, the local officials, many elected officials wrote letters in support. We lobbied for and worked for the flexibility, and ultimately the company just could not withstand the delays and the time that it took to get through the process, and that proposal unraveled. Oregon Trail Beef, which has been an Oregon success story for years, which has produced very high-quality product that's shipped to high-end restaurants, especially in Southern California and elsewhere, wanted to do a processing plant in eastern Oregon. They were not able to find a site that was large enough to accommodate, and they ultimately went to Idaho, to Caldwell, where they didn't have the same restrictions for land use. And I guarantee you that that company is a good neighbor and the community is a beneficiary of their investment. We lost that investment. There was several other examples, and an electronics plant couldn't find a parcel large enough and couldn't get through the community couldn't get through the urban growth expansion process in a timely manner to accommodate the siting of a company that would have brought multiple jobs. The city of Nissa points out that within the last decade, the population has dropped from 5,000 to 3,200. The feature of Main Street now are empty storefronts. The problem there is that without competitiveness in the community to attract businesses, the businesses simply leave Oregon and go to Idaho, or the business owners leave Oregon and live in Idaho and run their businesses in Oregon. Obviously, Idaho is a better competitor when it comes to siting facilities and attracting investment, because they can get through their planning process relatively easily. I would challenge all of you to go to Ontario, cross the bridge, and take a look at thriving communities that are not developed in a way that depresses the quality of living or harms the sustainability. On the contrary, you know, the unemployment rate is lower, the per capita income is higher, there are more buildings being built, more single-family residences, and this is within cities, folks. This is not out on the resource land. Ontario and NHISA point out that in a three-year period, only 75 homes were built in Malheur County, while across the river in Payette County, 206 new homes were being built. Over the last 3 years, and for a town of 11,000 people, that number of homes being constructed is a pretty pathetic performance. The multiple listing services in that three-year period showed that almost 1,100 homes, new homes sold in Payette County, while only 600 homes sold in the same three-year period in Malheur County. The point I'm trying to make here, I think, is one that we've made before. Centralized planning may look good on paper, but in practice it strangles small communities that don't have the depth on the bench to get through the planning processes, for whom appeals by various interested parties simply overtake their ability and overturn their opportunity. So at the end of the day, you know, I don't think folks in Eastern Oregon want to see two-thirds of the state paved over. What they want to see is sustainable communities where their kids don't have to leave the community in order to make a living. It's a feature that most of us in rural Oregon are very well familiar with. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll take any questions and hope that others that wish to offer testimony can demonstrate that we're willing to work with interested parties and cooperators, and we want to make sure that we do not overturn opportunities to maintain irrigated agriculture or high-value farmlands or any of the values that those rural communities also sustain and thrive on. They are the first line, actually, of defense for high-value agricultural land and high-value grazing land and grape land. But I guarantee you that some of the ground in Eastern Oregon should be growing families and growing employment opportunities, and that's what's lacking. Questions, Mr. Yes. Chair and others?
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you, Senators. I really appreciate the motives behind these. Just to clarify, so the issue here is not with the standards, but they're with the process, right? I mean, if, you know, comparing Oregon to Idaho or to Washington, it's the challenge is not that we have, you know, tougher standards, but rather that our process is more complex and time-consuming and daunting and complicated.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could answer in this way. When I go to Washington State, I see a vibrant mix of agricultural lands that are contiguous and protected. I see industrial components in communities close to cities where infrastructure is located, and I see residential developments that are compatible with those land uses. You would certainly conclude from an observation that they have a regulated system there. I see the same thing in Idaho. You do see a lot of irrigated agriculture. You see a lot of upland dryland wheat farming. You see row crops and tree fruit crops there. Side of the Snake River is just every bit as fertile as our side. But they also seem to be able to provide more affordable housing and accommodate more potential job-creating development. So if I look at the outcomes, you know, I see the same outcomes in Idaho and Washington, but I see fewer beneficial outcomes in Oregon. It is partly the process. It may be that the single missing factor is the ability of local decision makers to make decisions that reflect local conditions. So, you know, nobody's suggesting that we repeal Senate Bill 100 or overturn Oregon's heritage of protecting its high-value lands. What we are suggesting is that, due to the distances and the differences between climate, altitude, and physical features, flexibility should be accorded the local elected officials, not because they will develop without regard to the environment or sustainability, but because they have so far not been able to thrive under Oregon's land use system. That's the fact. They're not thriving. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator.
Not a question, but a little bit with kind of to follow up with Senator Farioli. In my experience in working in Idaho, and I have experience working here in Oregon, and what the fundamental difference between the two states is at the state level, Idaho's land use planning is flexible, and it gives more flexibility at the county and the city levels. It bumps it down to the local levels, and they have more flexibility. So you look at county by county differences, and those differences are how different counties are growing. So that's the fundamental difference. Ours is a very rigid, state-controlled land use planning system, where Idaho's is a lot more flexible and lets a lot more decisions being made in the county and the city levels.
Vice Chair.
Thank you. Being in the industry also, I've always found that our land use laws are very restrictive, and they drive up costs. And it's one of the reasons why we can't have affordable housing, is because land inside someplace is extremely expensive, and land outside is basically considered to be worthless because it's unbuildable. Senator Canope, your legislation here gives a flexibility it doesn't take away Senate Bill 100, but gives a flexibility so that communities can grow, because we're bringing in people. Lots of people are moving to our state, 1.2 million from 1990. So we have to have a place to put them. But without the flexibility, the more urban areas are looking for vertical construction, and the rural areas want that individual home type. So could you discuss yours a little bit as how the flexibility would not impede Senate Bill 100, but would enhance it?
Yeah, Chair Dembro and Vice Chair Olson, thank you for the question. Yeah, in fact, it really isn't changing the standards so much as it is giving, in many cases, emergency situations, the opportunity for the local elected officials. And again, we want to think about, we have standards in place, we have the goals that are set forth in Oregon land use law, but when you apply those, they're not really able to work in emergency situations. And so when we get down to low land supplies, which is what we currently have in Central Oregon, there isn't the flexibility there for those local decision makers to be able to solve the problem. So we're going back up, kind of the chain back up to the state, and that takes months, if not years, to get those things done. And it's complicated and it's expensive. And so really what we're just asking for is the flexibility for, especially in those emergency situations, for those local decision makers to be able to do that. I mean, they've been elected. We have local planning commissions, and so it's not like those decisions are, not being made in the public arena, because they are. And so I think that flexibility will go a long way toward alleviating some of the problems that we have in the markets today.
Senator Farrelly, I remember, I believe it was last year or year before, we talked about Eastern Oregon being able to split larger lots into smaller lots to bring in more folks and stuff like that. But a lot of the outrage was from the urban center saying you're changing land use laws. Could you just reflect on that a little bit and talk about the flexibility we need?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Senator Olson. The rub has always been that local farmers and ranchers are dubious about the idea that a smaller lot size would bring in developers who'd build summer homes and vacation houses and second houses, and eventually you end up with a conflict on right to farm issues, and you know, ranching and tree fruit growing, orchardists, orchards, you know, virtually all of agriculture can be incompatible with residential development. So the rub's always been, gee, we don't want too many of these houses built right in close to our high-value farmland. Let me suggest to you that if we just look at soil maps in eastern Oregon, you will find areas that are not qualified for any sort of high-value ranching or farming. Even the grazing land has to be in very large acreages to make it viable. The joke over there is that when we develop cows with a mouth 6 foot wide that can run 30 miles an hour to graze, we'll be able to fully utilize the sagebrush country out there. And some of these ecosystems are relatively fragile. So there are some concerns that we need to pay attention to. And believe me, the folks over there that would be developing their land use plans will be sensitized to these issues by their own population. So what we'll focus on, I believe, would be urban growth boundary expansions and development of areas that aren't classified by anybody's lexicon as high-value farmland. It won't be land that you can grow grapes on. It won't be orchard land. It won't be irrigated bottomland. You know, I'll also point out that in a place like Malheur County that has 10,000 square miles, only 10% of that land is arable, and it's all on the bottom by the rivers. But we could use the uplands to develop some opportunities for locating job-creating enterprises and a few homes. I guess the other thing I'll point out, and I think this is the most important, Oregon is alone in its land use system nationally. Other people that have faced exactly the same set of challenges have been able to come up with a solution based on local flexibility. Washington State has 39 counties. 10 of them have opted out. And those 10, if you look at those 10 counties, they chose the opt-out to develop their own land use local laws because of the same problems we're trying to resolve here. So we didn't just pick up Senate Bill 432 a whole cloth. You know, we're not trying to do a mass frontal attack on land use planning in Oregon. What we're trying to do is look at a successful model in a neighboring sister state and say it worked there. It could probably work here. We just have to have the courage to give it a try. We've been very clear about giving this an opportunity to work, putting a sunset on this. You know, put a reasonable period of opportunity and an opt-out, but make it possible for these local communities to attract new industry, attract new residents, and revitalize the community, retain some of their own kids, and really allow them to be contributory to Oregon's sustainability as opposed to being the beneficiary of transfer funds that come from more productive urban areas.
One final follow-up,
okay.
If you don't mind.
Yes, go ahead. Then we'll have to wrap up.
Okay, which is fine. I just want to make this point. Oregon's land use laws are extremely rigid, and for the rural communities, when you have to go into the process and go to LCDC, if someone appeals a decision that's made, it's very costly. It perhaps Ben could afford the cost, but NISA or Ontario might not be able to. With a little bit of flexibility, the cost restructure is reduced, but it allows the cities to be the stewards of their own land, but still allows the land use process to work. Could you?
Mr. Chair, if I might. Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman, that is absolutely accurate. If you were looking at depth on the bench, and you put in an appeal lawyer from an agency against a city manager or the city attorney, all you have to do is look at the fact that Baker, Grant, Wallowa, Sherman, and Gillam counties all have lower population today than they did in 1950. Their tax base is smaller. the relative resources are smaller. They simply don't have the capacity. So our system is set up so that interested parties outside the community can appeal. And often they do so with very talented attorneys. And they don't have to appeal on all the issues at one time. There's no consolidation of causes. So what happens is they end up, the cities and counties that would try to get through the land use process end up in being kicked up and down, back and forth in the LCDC process. And it's, frankly, I think there may be much merit to the appellant's causes. But at the end of all of the conversations, those cities and counties and small jurisdictions run out of steam, run out of opportunity, run out. You know, the folks that would do the development get fed up, they leave, they go to Idaho, they go to Washington, they go to Nevada. And so our problem really, it is process, Mr. Chair. The laws are well-intentioned, and they've worked well to get us to this point. I think it's time for an adjustment. We should try this, because it's worked so well in our neighboring state.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Actually, Senator Knope, I do have a question. With respect to the housing issue, so last year we had a bargain. I wouldn't call it a grand bargain. It was a little bargain related to housing. And one of the elements, there was a bill that has a pilot program in a small or medium-sized city to extend their urban growth boundary for the purpose of affordable housing. Do you know where that is? Or maybe some of the subsequent speakers can address that. Should we wait and see how that's working? You know, that would be a counter argument.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't know exactly where that is, but I do know that there hasn't been any impact in that yet. I had heard that it was slow getting out of the gate. But, I mean, you know the emergency situation that our communities are in, and I would prefer not to wait. And maybe it's that you pass this bill with a 5-year sunset, and so, you know, we kind of take care of the problem that exists today and then relook at it, a few years from now, so you're not necessarily committed to the policy forever, that we have to revisit it and see, in fact, you know, are these emergency things working? Are they being used by local governments? Do they need to be tweaked in some way? Or, have we alleviated the problems? But I definitely think we need to continue to look at and try to modernize the land use system and give it that flexibility that's needed so our communities, especially rural communities, have the opportunity to quite frankly, exist, because they are being exterminated year by year as we speak. And you just look at the population levels and the businesses moving out of town, and at some point, it's death in a ghost town, and, we don't need any more ghost towns for people to come see here in Oregon. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes. Members of the committee.
Okay, I'm going to bring up our first panel, and we'll start with the proponents. Gary Thompson, Dave Honeycutt, and Aaron Doyle, please. Commissioner, you want to start?
Mr. Chair, panel. My name is Gary Thompson. I'm a Sherman County judge. I am one of those small counties, 1,700. Before this winter, it was 1,760 people, but I ended up going to 13 funerals this winter alone. So I don't know exactly where it is. It all depends on the birth rate. But it is dropping, and it's been dropping ever since 100 was put into play, not necessarily because of that ruling. There's a number of reasons. Right now, Sherman County is extreme shortage of housing, but we have no place to build them. I've got two deputy sheriffs that are looking for a house in the county. We've got school teachers that are looking for houses in the county. We got employers that have got employees that are looking for places to live. With the exception of the two deputies, everyone else can live 40 miles away in the city of the Dalles and drive 40 miles one way to work. And that's what's happening. The deputies are required to live within the county. We've got one deputy currently living in a single-wide RV at an RV park. He's lived in it now for 5 years. Still can't find a house. It's all primarily because our urban growth boundary is the city limits. It was my forefathers set that up before I became a county judge. I was probably a dirt farmer at that time, but a wheat farmer. But our forefathers set it up so that it was just the city limits, which gave us no room. And within the city, there are vacant lots. But everybody that owns a vacant lot next to them don't want neighbors, so there's nothing for sale. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard spot. I'm in favor of Senator Ferrioli's bill, mainly because it'll give us the opportunity to take a look at some non-resource land that's currently AEFU, and maybe tweak some a little bit to get some houses built. The caveat, though, is you've got to have water, you've got to have enough soil to be able to put in a septic system, and you got to have power. So that's going to eliminate about 90% of the land that's currently available in the county. If there's any questions, I'm glad to answer.
We'll come back to you.
Okay.
Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. I'm sure it'll come as a shock to the committee, but I'm in support of every one of these fine pieces of legislation. but particularly Senate Bill 432, I won't plow a lot of the ground that Senator Ferrioli has already done on this bill, other than to let you know that there are 10 of the 39 Washington counties that have opted out, and the Growth Management Act was enacted about 25 years after Senate Bill 100. So Washington had a chance to see how things were going down here, and that gave them some guidance on as to how they should act and pattern their law. And I think, frankly, that they've done a little bit better job. The hindsight being 2020, I like what they've done. And I think they've done a better job of doing that. We don't know, I'm not sure, and I don't think any of us can be sure what would happen if Senate Bill 432 passed. It's hard to know. What I can tell you is, and I think the evidence is bears this out, is that what we're doing now isn't working. So we know that the path we're on isn't working. So why should we be afraid to try something else out? I looked while I was sitting back there waiting to testify. I looked at the eight counties and the demographics in the eight counties between 2010 and 2015, which are the latest numbers. All eight of those counties, as Senator Ferrioli said, six of the eight counties, the population in six of the eight counties is smaller today than it was in 1950. Between 2010 and 2015, the population in all eight of the counties has declined. And so they're getting smaller. They've gotten smaller since the last census, and they're continuing to shrink. At some point, they're going to go away completely. And when you have a third of the state, that's what these eight counties represent in land area, about 35,000 square miles of land area, with 73,000 people, which is continuing to shrink, you're really creating that's not healthy for the state. It's certainly not healthy for folks that want to go over and visit some of those areas where there basically will not be any services at all. They're not frontier counties anymore. They're just not counties at all. that 73,000 population in 35,000 square miles is smaller than the city of Medford. Medford has 78,000 people in 25 square miles. And so the only thing that I'll add, we should, I suspect that we'll hear from some of the opponents that this bill, if adopted, 432, will create some kind of unbridled, sprawling, unmanaged growth. And I'd point out, and one of the things that frustrates me the most about that argument is it presumes that the county elected officials like Judge Thompson, if given the opportunity, will go out and do the most crazy and destructive things to their counties. And I just don't think that's true. I don't think any of those elected officials, and I've met most of them out in those areas, would be of that mindset. And it also assumes that if we didn't have statewide land use planning, that development would occur. We could go out to Wheeler County right now, and if we eliminated the land use, the state land use goals in Wheeler County, I think Wheeler County 10 years from now will look the same as it does today. You're not going to get a developer, and I have a lot of developer members. You're not going to get a developer to go out and build in Wheeler County just because they can. There needs to be interest and a market. And so the concept that without Senate Bill 100, these counties would go off in some untoward direction, I think, is just wrong. So we're very much supportive of 432. We like the idea that we need some additional industries. Obviously, given last week's mining bill, we're working on that as well, and would hope that that the committee would take this bill to heart and move it along after we've been at it for about 10 years now.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, also in favor of all of the fine pieces of legislation that are before you today. Instead of talking about each one individually, I kind of wanted to touch on what these bills represent to local government and how we would have to approach things if any of these were to pass. The flexibility that we constantly look for as local government is about the fact that local city officials live in the community day to day and are making educated decisions about what their citizens have asked for, what they feel they need, and the opportunities they'd like to see come before them. But we don't just go out and build to build. We try to build in ways that are intelligent because we're also managing our own resources. So one of the first things that would have to be looked at is, of course, the infrastructure needs of any sort of new grand development. If we were to extend the urban growth boundary to accommodate housing rapidly, we'd have to be prepared and have the financial security that we could actually extend the infrastructure out to them. Or if we're looking at an economic development model that allows for 5 years of shovel ready has a meaning, and that meaning means literally we have everything there, but the building, and the building is going to be dependent upon the user. So that infrastructure cost is going to inhibit any sort of free will of going out there and just starting to build because we can. But also, more importantly, there's that component of local understanding. This is, out in Eastern Oregon, I would imagine that the county commissioners and judges see their constituency pretty regularly, but city officials see them even more regularly, because if there's one grocery store in town, you're going to run into everybody. Even in larger cities, you run into a lot of local officials when you're out. So they have direct lines of communication with the local citizens, and they also are very familiar with the economic basis from which their communities survive and thrive. So just because you could build the next Intel in Malheur County, that's perhaps not the direction, the economic picture that Malheur County has. You're not going to use up all the land to take away from the ranching opportunities that might be out there. You're going to do the things you can to help develop the opportunities to do better, more successful ranching. Because you live, you work, you stand side by side these folks on day to day at the local level. And so having that local perspective helps make smart decisions. And the crux of a lot of this, I think, particularly in Eastern Oregon, comes from the land use system basis is on population forecasting. Urban growth boundaries can be expanded when the population forecast says you're going to need to accommodate for more people. But when you have to do that forecasting based on past practices, and the past practice is that people are leaving, you can't do anything to accommodate the possibility of enticing new opportunities that might help people stay, or even bring in a couple, 10, five, 10 more jobs. That might be a big boon in a community of 200. So by having a land use system that says the starting place for almost all of your decisions is population forecasts, and you're a city or a county that's losing folks, tell me what you're supposed to do with that. You can't say we need more housing because you can't say we have more population growth. You can't say we don't have enough economic opportunity to justify having more economic developable lands because we don't have more people coming in. But we're not going to get more people coming in unless we can build them housing, we can make the land ready for them, we can start planning the infrastructure for it, that we can start enticing companies to, maybe you don't want to live and work and play in my home county of Washington County because things are a little bit more expensive there, but we hear the coast is nice and they're looking for some economic opportunity and they might have some lands available to you. If we can be a little bit more flexible, a little bit more rapidly able to respond to some of those opportunities, and then on the other side, those folks who might be interested in coming to those areas can see that there's that flexibility there instead of going, well, I know that, you know, Oregon has land use laws and I'm not sure what your urban growth boundary looks like and I don't feel like dealing with it. And I'm not saying that there's a ton of that out there, but the little bit that is there for those communities that are looking at just losing populations because there is an opportunity, having the opportunity to say, we will make the opportunity happen for you, that's a big bonus. And having that flexibility to do it locally and not having to be dependent upon the state to get exceptions to do that would mean a lot to those communities. The last thing I'd point you to is in 2015, when this the Senate Bill 432's predecessor version was Senate Bill 25, there's a letter in there from a long-term land use planner who works out in Eastern Oregon. It's listed under my name if you really want to delve into OLIS. And I think he speaks very eloquently to the problems that a small community has in trying to do that economic opportunity analysis and the amount that it costs a small community to do the little things they need to take advantage of an currently existing airport to try and drive a little bit more job opportunity. And I commend that to you as a way to consider what it is that these bills represent we're asking for. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? So just to clarify, so these bills, some of these bills have to do with employment and others housing, right? Some to attract business and others housing. And so we probably should, maybe it's a mistake that we've lumped them all together because they're very different situations, right? Some of them have to do with pressure because of housing shortages, and others pressure because of economic morbidity, right? And so, Judge, in your county as an example, in Sherman County, there's not a need for more housing in order to accommodate housing pressure, right? And so your primary issue is in getting more industry to locate in your county? No. Yes. So, yeah.
Senator,
explain to
them. No. We're short housing, period. The housing, we got zero. Our rental housing is 100% full. And there's a waiting list for anybody. What rental housing we have, there is a waiting list for people to rent the house as soon as somebody either passes away or moves out of town. There's somebody to come in to live in that house. The problem with it is most of those rental houses were built in the 1950s and 1960s, and they're not in very good shape.
So how does expanding the urban growth boundary, correct that?
We can't. We can't expand it.
But if you could.
I don't think it would make any difference. Most of the people that want to move into my county want to the 5-acre little farmette or whatever you want to call it, someplace where they can have a horse and some chickens and a cow. Those are the people that are currently living in some of our my cities, would like to move out of the cities and either sell or rent their house. But there's no possibility of being able to do that.
I think I might be able to answer your question.
Sure.
I think part of the problem with our communities is the fact that with the lack of housing, the housing costs go up because of supply and demand, and industry that wants to move in or business wants to move in wants to have a workforce that can live there and work. And if they can't live there and work, then the industry doesn't want to move there. So we have to have the housing so that the industry can come in and say, this is where we want to be, this is the business we want to establish. And if a new business, like a dress shop or anything, wants to establish in town, they look at the population center and they say, well, there's no chance for this to grow, so my market is limited. I don't want to open up here. But if the urban growth boundary were expanded, they would see the potential that new homes, new subdivisions could be built. They would open up a business, and, of course, that would attract other business. Am I kind of on the right track?
Chair Dembro, if I may. I think the urban growth boundary expansion, if the urban growth boundary were easier to expand in some of these communities, what it does is it providing that the limitation on urbanized levels of development when we're building more houses and tighter in, as opposed to what we demand of rural lands to be pretty light on housing and other structures. Expanding the urban growth boundary, I think, would allow for more housing to come in and meet some of those needs. And I have heard a couple of things. I have never sat in on a housing meeting where we're talking with housing advocates where any part of the state has been said to have enough housing and hasn't had some sort of difficulty finding affordable housing at all price points. For some communities that do have some of the more affordable workforce housing, they might be missing executive housing, and so why would you locate something there if your executives aren't going to want to live there and are going to have to drive a mile and a half or an hour and a half down from Washington? That's a story that I've heard out of Pendleton before. So if you make it slightly simpler to expand the UGB, less reliant on the population forecast, you can show that opportunity to develop that housing. And if we can show that need when you have a waiting list for rentals inside the city, it relieves some of those thoughts and processes about wanting to, if you can't find a 5-acre lot to do your hobby farm on, maybe you can live inside a slightly more rural urban area. And that's kind of, if you drive through the towns on the east, which I know that you see it's a very different than what it looks like in the Willamette Valley when we do urbanization. But having more space in which to put that housing is going to encourage more housing to come. More housing means that the folks who are thinking about jobs might be more willing to place those. You know, if you can open up some sort of industrial use that has 10 more jobs, that you know that your workers can live there instead of drive from one of the larger urban centers. They can live within that community, and that maybe there's a little bit more land. It's a little bit cheaper because everything's a little bit cheaper when things are smaller. And the expansion of the UGB just shows that we're still thinking about how we use our land so that urban development is tighter, smaller, more dense than if we were to just open up the county to say you can build whatever you want wherever you want. And I don't think that that's anything that any of our counties want to do or any of our cities want to do. But I think that's kind of the drive here for some of these communities. For other communities, it's that it's super popular and we're just not fast enough with our UGBs. And I think that's a different and very complicated question.
Yes, Senator Roper.
Yeah, and I guess what I would say is, having talked and looked at this, and I actually also think 432 is something that could make some sense. It has to do with somebody comes in and says, we would love to build here. We'd love to have an opportunity to do this. And you've got a group in some of these counties, like the forefathers, who said, we don't need any of that urban growth boundary. We like what we are. So we're putting it right here next to the county. So now they have no option. And the time it takes to go through a whole process means that the person that just came in and talked to you about being there knows it's not going to work in their lifetime or in the time necessary for them to commit to it. When you have flexibility in it, you say, someone comes in and says they want to do it, you can say, let's look around and see what kind of area that would make sense to us. And if they could go about and then expand in just that area, I don't think there's anybody in Eastern Oregon that wants to take away good ranging land or farmland. What they want to do is have the flexibility to be able to say, somebody's here, they want to be here, we can figure out where to put them that works well for us and everybody else. And having a little bit more, at the same time, ability to build houses, there's nobody rushing out there to do that right now. And I don't think any of the people think that there's going to be the next gold rush to find the housing. But because our process takes so long, it's overwhelming them to think about how do we do it when somebody does show up that wants to be there. And how do we build into a system? And I've looked at the Washington one. I agree. They've been able to manage it without amazing growth. I don't think there's a lot of people standing around in our urban areas wanting to go out to Sherman, Wheeler, or any of these other counties. They just, that isn't what they want. But those people that are out in those counties want to save their way of life, and they want to have the ability to, in a fairly short period of time, figure out the right place to make whatever investment that wants to come here. And I keep thinking I would love to see us figure out a way that people could acknowledge that we're not changing it anyplace else. Infill is great in these other places. What he's saying in his city is infill doesn't work so well because the people who have their house don't want anybody around them. So they just buy the three lots when the people die, and they say, that's my property. I have a big lawn now. That's what I want.
That's exactly right.
And I'm not sharing that land with anybody else because it took me my whole lifetime to get those other three lots. Two other people had to die before I got those, but I got them. And I'm not sharing it with anybody else. And I know a lot of those people. And that makes it really hard for local government to try to figure out how to find a few other pieces that weren't picked up. I mean, some of these people talk to their neighbors for a long time to make sure that they're the ones first in line for that property.
Yeah. I'm starting to think about Monopoly games. But anyway, thank you all three of you for coming.
Thank you.
Can we have Becky Steckler, Cindy Robert, and Peggy Lynch, please?
Good afternoon, Chair. Chair Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Becky Steckler, and I'm the Program and Policy Manager for the Oregon Chapter of the American Planning Association. And I think that and I would say that the Oregon Chapter of the American Planning Association opposes all five of these bills. And I think that the previous testimony has definitely illustrated the complexities and the challenges that come with designing any kind of a community, whether it's inside of an urban growth boundary, out or out in our rural areas. And I think it's been a simplistic and sometimes seductive argument to say if only it was easy to expand urban growth boundaries, then we would have plenty of jobs, housing would be affordable, and our lives would be better. I guess I would argue that Oregon is working, and Oregonians are working very hard to build the kinds of communities and attract the kinds of jobs that are really important to all the people who live here. And I keep on thinking of the 2013 Values and Beliefs Survey that was done, and every time we ask Oregonians, what do you care about? And they care about a place where their kids can live and the natural beauty that surrounds us, whether it's at the coast or if it's in the Wallowa Mountains. They want to direct that kind of growth into cities, and they want to preserve farm and forest land. And I can't help but wonder what would have happened to Eastern Oregon economies during the last recession without the protections that we've had and the strong both farm and forest economies that we do have in those areas that are in no part due to Oregon's land use planning program. I guess I would also make the argument that historically, when cities first drew their UGBs back in the 1970s and 80s, they were still trying to figure out, how do you do this analysis? Where do you draw that line? And they drew them pretty generous. And then over the years, as they've continued to either update those or do other types of planning processes, I think everyone on both sides has gotten a little bit more sophisticated on doing appeals and just how to really work the system. And the number of lawsuits that we have seen, I think, probably illustrates that. And over that time as well, we've seen the reduction on the amount of requirements to really to comprehensively review comprehensive plans, and also a constriction on the resources that are available, the loss of grant funds from the Department of Land Conservation, the restriction in the funding for the Department of Land Conservation and Development, which makes it all tougher when you don't have those resources to really do the work. And I guess it really, to do that work takes hundreds, if not thousands, of people that all have to get together and they have to agree about a whole bunch of different things. And I would say this is one of the reasons that the Oregon chapter, over this last summer and fall, worked on a report that we attached as part of the testimony on Senate Bill 608. And it's called The Challenges to Development. It's not just about the urban growth boundary. And I guess I want to emphasize that definitely land and the availability of land is an important component for any kind of development, whether it's for jobs or for housing. But there's a lot of things that come into play, and it's definitely, it might not even be the whole thing. And what this report talks about a lot is that for so many of these communities, it's important to think about where your jobs and housing and shops and schools and all of those things are going, because the cost for infrastructure is so expensive that they can't afford not to. And I guess I would make that argument. I know the League of Oregon Cities, in a report, I think in 2014, it's in this report, said that there's at least a $2 billion need for additional infrastructure. And so definitely the Oregon Land Use Planning Framework provides that ability to really think comprehensively about how we're going to make those investments and how can we do it efficiently and effectively. It also looks at, we worked with Echo Northwest, an economics and consulting firm, and they have probably done more housing needs analysis and economic opportunities analyses over the last, well, as long as they've been around. And when they looked at the analysis that they have done over the last 10 years, especially when it comes to housing, where they found the greatest deficits is in multifamily, in that higher density housing. And so just expanding the urban growth boundary for so many of our communities is not the only answer. And while some of them do have a deficit in single family, for single family homes, they definitely had a strong need for that multifamily today. And so, and that's really where you have to think about what are the policies inside of our city limits, especially in downtowns and in corridors or closer to jobs, near transit, and all those things that are so very important. And then finally, there's so many other things that can disrupt the apple cart related to the different kinds of development that we have. So everything, and definitely the recession, I think, illustrated that, access to capital, everything from a lack of support from neighbors that can really make the development themselves much more difficult. I guess I would like to wrap up that, as I had mentioned, I think Oregon's land use planning programs and the 19 goals that we use to really do the planning in Oregon reflect the goals that Oregonians have today, not only just back in 40 years ago, but then also today. And it also gives us that framework to tackle new and emerging issues. For example, how are we going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And definitely our program is probably more well-equipped than many other states around the country. And as also for those effects on climate change, we've probably seen fewer losses from catastrophic wildfires, especially in rural areas, because we have less development out in those areas. And then it costs less for the state. It costs much more money to protect those buildings that are in the wild-urban interface. I would also say that, you know, the legislature is going to be considering a huge transportation package that I hope passes, because transportation is just so critical for so many parts of our society. And we have a responsibility to spend that money effectively and efficiently. And then finally, I would say also for protection of endangered species and the amount of work that has gone in rural areas of the state around protecting habitat for sage grouse. It provides us a framework that we can then do really important things that are important for Oregon citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Steckler. Cindy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm here on behalf of Metro today, speaking specifically to Senate Bills 602, 608, and 618. As you know, Metro is the elected government in the greater Portland area, and one of our primary responsibilities is, in fact, land use and managing the growth of our region. So I've been trying to listen intently to this because I have different clients who feel differently about these kinds of issues. One of the things that came to my mind is, does land use law perhaps, is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. Should county size matter? Should what states around us are doing matter? Maybe. Should we have local flexibility? Perhaps. Do we have a housing problem? Absolutely. But Senate Bill 602, 608, and 16 conflate housing supply and land supply. They are two different things. Housing supply is an immediate problem. And we, with some short-term responses, it might be handled within 1 to 2 years. But land supply is a long-term issue, which doesn't show any benefits for almost 20 years. So adding more land to our supply will do nothing immediately to help the housing problem, maybe in 5 to 10 years. But we already have tens of thousands of acres, at least in the Portland area, where we can make long-term land supply decisions. Furthermore, Metro believes that making these kind of changes to land use laws needs to be done by building some broad consensus. We've brought a bill to the legislature that's already passed the House, where we felt like that happened within the communities within our area. Broad consensus, agreement, and we're not sure that that happened on these bills. So specifically on the three bills, I'll just make some brief comments. First of all, Senate Bill 602 allows a broad waiver of any land use or planning goal as necessary to establish and maintain a 5-year supply of shovel-ready employment sites. Allowing the total waiver of any goal is a significant departure from our current land use practice. Furthermore, the real issue for getting industrial lands ready is not having the land. It's connecting roads and water pipes in the area, cleaning up brownfield contamination, and mitigating wetland constraints. 602 simply adds land to long-term supply without addressing the development readiness that is truly at the heart of the problem. Senate Bill 608 allows UGB additions if an area has low vacancy rates and needs housing supply. If an area already has a 20-year supply of land, adding more land to that 20-year land supply will not accelerate the housing supply. Housing supply is dependent on the market and development-ready land. Development readiness relies on city planning areas, enacting zones, annexing land, funding infrastructure, and so on. The bill makes the error of trying to resolve the problem of an immediate shortage of built housing and low vacancy rates with the solution of adding land to a 20-year land supply. In Metro's view, the solution does not match the problem. Finally, Senate Bill 618 allows local governments to declare a land use emergency. Well, we're not sure what land use emergency is going to be defined as. We can tell you that, of course, the housing issue feels like an emergency to a lot of us. But with that 20-year supply of land already inside a UGB, land is there. It's empty. Lack of land is not the problem. It is not the emergency. In Metro, we've added 26,000 acres of land over the past 15 years, and most of it remains undeveloped. Home building has lagged in recent years due to the recession and the home mortgage collapse during a time in which our population continued to grow. It is not lacking because of lack of buildable land. Thank you for hearing our concerns about Senate Bill 602, 608, and 618, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Thank you very much, Cindy. I can take I can take my comments on 602, 608, and 612 or 618 off my list because, in fact, those were the things that I had had lined out on those particular bills, and those are exactly the issues that I was looking at. I want to address a few things that I have heard so far. The League does oppose all of these bills. We are interested in trying to find solutions and have worked on, for instance, in 2013, House Bill 2254, which helped create a new simplified UGB process. We are hoping that will be used and useful to cities who need to expand, and it does recognize that we do get it, that there have been lots of changes in our land use system over the years, and we're ready to have conversations about more of those. Senator Denborough, you asked about what is House Bill 4079, the UGB pilots that was passed. The rules are done. They were done quickly. And the applications for those two opportunities to have some pilots outside of UGBs, I believe, are ready to go. I'm not certain that that's the case, but if not, they are very close. The criteria has been set, and that has worked on. So we are recognizing the importance of that. I heard that that dirt inside is more expensive than dirt outside. Yep. And the reason is that there are services inside. There are things that cost, and therefore the land costs more because those services are linked to that dirt. The other thing I want to mention is the other reason, frankly, is that we deliberately tried to keep agricultural land cheap to be sure that we supported the agricultural industry. And that was a part of the Senate Bill 100 discussion. And that's why we have the farm deferral, is in order to recognize that issue. There was a conversation about things are different in other states. And for instance, in Idaho was one of those. Yesterday on the radio, I was listening to Josh Lerner, our state economist, who frankly said it's not land use that is the issue in Oregon related to housing. It is the mortgage and lending crisis that occurred. And it is still taking time for that lending to happen, to get development to come back on, and for developers to be able to get the loans that they need to be able to do the job of building. In Central Oregon in Bend, the last time that Bend had their UGB, they annexed the entire UGB. Immediately, that UGB was developed. And then we had the housing crisis. Everybody, people in Oregon will know that in the Bend area, after the housing crisis, we had huge foreclosures, and they were in a huge downward spiral. And it was, frankly, because they took their 20-year land supply and allowed it to be built in a very short time. So, and I understand that the same is happening now in North Plains, and we'll see what happens there. The other points I wanted to try to make were that it's my understanding that Vail, and I'm not sure about Nyssa, but I think it was Vail and Nyssa together, and Ontario have all had recent UGB expansions. So although I suspect Grass Valley hasn't, and by the way, it's a great town, I do love to visit there. There are cities in eastern Oregon and in these eight counties who have land, have had a chance to expand, and have things happening within them. We need to make sure that we support those cities and make sure that the infrastructure that's already there is supported by new people. I will close there. One finer comment, the comment about the fact that the people buy their land, buy the lots next to them and don't allow them. Frankly, that's true all over the state. There's no way to control the owners of lands and letting them happen. It has been a real issue in the Corvallis area because Corvallis has a very few owners of property. And unless they're ready to sell that property to actually develop, it gets counted as a part of their UGB, but it can cause a problem. Frankly, the fact that we now have a housing boom, beginning housing boom, those lots are finally beginning to be sold and developed. But that is an issue about which I have no answer. But thank you for listening.
Thank you, Peggy. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you.
Hold on.
Okay, make it fast. We have a couple more panels.
Okay, a couple points.
Yes, sir.
You guys are the classic urban-rural divide. UGB works wonderful for the Valley, works wonderfully for Metro. But when you get to the other side of the mountain, it doesn't work so good. Comment that Ms. Steckler made
that the losses are from forest fires are reduced because there's not a lot of growth. Well, there'd be a lot of people that would like to live out there if they could. And perhaps they would be able to manage the forest better so they wouldn't be burned on. Ms. Roberts, you're talking about broad consensus. Well, when you have 73,000 in eight counties, it's difficult to get broad consensus when you have 5 million people live in the valley that don't want East County or East State to do anything. It's very difficult to get broad consensus. And then the discussion on cheap land, I just looked up Madison, Indiana, just pulled it off the top of my head because I'm from Indiana. 1.5 acres with city sewer, city water, $14,000. I can go down the list. Costs are exacerbated when you put them inside a city. Yes, there are city services, but when there's a finite amount, supply and demand drives that cost up. In Canby, $150,000 a lot. You can't expect me to build cheap houses on that kind of stuff. So I'm just saying that you need to open your eyes and look at Eastern Oregon as a little different from what the valley is.
Mr. Just Chair, if I could just really quickly.
I was going to allow that to be an editorial comment.
Yes. Senator, I absolutely agree with you, and you know that I usually agree with you on all these kinds of issues. In this particular case, I'm speaking on behalf of Metro, and that is the area here. The Senator Ferriello-Isabel, we didn't comment on that. There are issues, I think, that are different around the state, and I certainly am not saying that the way we do it at Metro should apply to the rest of the state. That being said, this body did adopt Senate Bill 100. It is a land use program for the whole state, and it does, in fact, ask for some kind of consensus building, not necessarily consensus, but working together. And I think that's the issue that I was trying to bring forward, is we need to work a little bit more on that. And in doing that, look at it with a vision of how different areas are affected. You're right.
Okay, thank you all very much.
Oh, I will be, even though I have a problem.
Thank you. Okay, in pursuit of expediency and consensus, I will call up Sean Gillians, and to cap it off, John Chandler.
Oh, I thought you said we were done.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, in support of repealing Senate Bill 100, in strong opposition to House Bill 2004. Sorry, I thought that was some of the things we've been talking about today, but we do have those positions. Mr. Chair, we are in support of the bills that are in front of you, and I think you've heard a little bit about sort of the pressure that's been put on us now that we're 40-plus years into our land use system. You heard about the drawing of urban growth boundaries, and yes, there were some that were drawn relatively tight or right at the city limits in areas, but by and large, as we heard from the planners, they were drawn rather large. So now we're feeling the true impacts 40 years in as we actually grow, as those oversized boundaries are no longer sufficient. And with all due respect to my colleague from Metro, I don't necessarily believe that things work so well in Metro. We in the development community don't necessarily believe that there's a 20-year buildable supply in there when you have areas like Damascus that take up a large portion of the urban growth boundary in the area, and Damascus is an area that will never be developed going forward. In addition, in order to have the new development we have now in South Hillsborough and South Cooper Mountain in Beaverton, you all actually had to step in and validate the urban growth boundary, which was commonly called the land use grand bargain. Mr. Chair, you mentioned the two pilot project bill going forward. If you'll recall, as part of our process, that's two pilot projects for affordable housing, 50 acres total max, 100 acres total in the state, and you would have thought that we actually repealed Senate Bill 100. I was looking back through the bill trying to figure out what we actually did given the hysteria that was generated in opposition to that. We're really looking at small things that could solve the problem. While I come up here and say, let's repeal Senate Bill 100, we know that's not politically viable. That's never going to happen in our lifetimes. And so in my time here, dating back even to the Big Look Task Force, which I was looking at the panel to see who was even around for the Big Look Task Force, we've sort of looked at issues. Big Look Task Force made some progress, got defunded because they were going perhaps too far, got money back to finish their project and scaled things back. We've never really taken a big swing in it, and we've never really given rural, Eastern Oregon an opportunity to experiment. And I think that's what more of these bills are focused on, particularly Senator Farioli's. It was interesting this session, as we talk about housing, we've talked about the unaffordability of it in our urban areas, but Oregon is very unique in that our housing in rural areas is also very unaffordable. And when you look at a map of unaffordable pockets in the U.S., most of the West Coast in their really rural areas doesn't have that bright red. We have a lot of bright red, and that's due to our land use system. And it's a policy decision that was made to preserve farm and forest, but we have to recognize that there are costs associated with that, and that's going to be increased housing costs by doing that. The bills, Senator Canope's bills, deal with housing emergencies. I don't think there's any doubt for all of us that we've sort of approached that point. The median home value in Oregon is now over $300,000. The median home value in the Portland area is now over $400,000. We don't have the job growth to keep pace with that. Even as rural Oregon is making some progress in getting close to the national average on employment, we haven't reached that. Last thing, Mr. Chair, because I know you guys are pressed for time, you talked about the employment land side of it too. I think my biggest criticism of our urban growth boundary as system as it relates to employment lands is it does not allow cities to be aspirational. As Ms. Doyle mentioned, it's based off past performance and where you could be. And cities who say, you know what, we're right on the I-5 corridor, we want to have more industrial lands than perhaps our population would support, and I'm talking about a city just 10 miles north of us, that's challenged in court. They spent 20 years, over $1 million in planning, and they were never able to get through the process until they finally went to mediation and significantly reduced their industrial lands in their UGB expansion because they were effectively told, no, you don't have that authority under state statute to be aspirational and hope to attract new jobs that would then bring the population with it. Mr. Chair, I'm guessing that we're not going to have a motion to move these bills forward. We look forward to the conversation as we continue this each session. I really would like, though, as we're looking at solutions, to come up with some land use things beyond just a two pilot project bill or an executive order that we couldn't even get through the legislature for three counties in Southern Oregon. We have to start seriously looking at our rural areas in particular, and I mean that in the coastal areas, not just Eastern Oregon. We have to look at the impacts that 40 years of statewide land use planning has had on that. With that, Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on roughly the same set of issues for the 597th time. We are supportive of these bills. And I'm trying to pique my frustration down because truly we have had this conversation many times. Oregon, as you heard earlier from Senator Farioli, is the only state in the country that does the land use planning the way we do, and in a state perhaps less self-actualized than ours, that might be a sign that perhaps we could learn from others. There's a thriving ag economy and a thriving timber economy in every other state in the country, including the very highly dense urbanized ones like New Jersey. There are other ways to preserve farm and forest land than the one we have opted, and there's certainly other ways to do so that aren't quite so strict, quite so rigorous, and aren't so damaging to rural parts of the state. My wife and I had occasion to be to Wyoming a few years ago. I hadn't been to Malheur County in quite a while, and when I drove, if you have not been out there, I would encourage you to do so. It'll break your heart. As you're heading west, you have the Boise Valley and economic development and housing production and vibrant economies, and you hit the Snake River and you get pawn shops and Walmart. And I'm not overstating it. And we collectively have let that happen. We may not have collectively done it, because I'm not sure there's any one thing you could point to, but we have stepped by and watched that happen. I gone on the internet while the committee was going today and checked the U.S. Census website. In 2015 in Wheeler County, there were zero building permits. In Gillum County, there were zero building permits. In Grant County, zero. Sherman County, zero. Harney County had a boom. They had seven. Baker County had 21. Malheur County had 31. That's a third of the state, 50 units, round numbers, rounding up. This something has to happen. If it's not these bills, I understand. But my word. It is. We've got to do something. If it's not the, maybe it's not the land use system. Isn't the only problem? Lord knows, it is lending. It is the lack of tradespeople. It is lack of infrastructure. It's lack of local capacity. But when you have a system as valley centric as ours is, that tends to look at all farmland as though it's the same, Farming in eastern Oregon on the coast is very different than farming here. Ranching out there is very different than ranching here. But we don't refuse to recognize those differences. We refuse to recognize that. I came back from Sun River a while back. There's 38 acres outside of Sisters. Has a big sign on it. EFU, 38 acres. You can't do anything on that. It's scrub, it's rock and sagebrush. Now, changing the zoning on that might not cause that anything to happen. But the fact that the zoning is there and making sure nothing happens is a sign to investors, is a sign to those communities, and it's frankly embarrassing that we don't take the problems facing those areas more seriously than we do. I understand the political volatility of this. Mr. Jillian's mentioned the Big Look. That was a bill that we promoted, barely got it through the legislature after two times, and all we wanted to do was to talk about the land use system, and it took two sessions to get it passed, and one round of defunding and a separate session to get the money back. It is politically viable. Volatile. I understand that. I'm not asking any of you to walk the plank on this issue. I would say, though, that there is a problem. We have seen it. We heard it from Senator Farioli. We heard it from Senator Knope. You can talk to your colleagues in those parts of the state. It is dire. Changing the land use system, going back to a Worcester-style model or something of that sort, it won't be magic. It'll help. And I find it more than passingly amusing, Mr. Chair and members, in closing. Well, actually, not quite in closing. I have to speak to the metro issue as well.
If you could speed up.
I will, Mr. Chair. But it is more than passingly ironic to me that we seem to have no trouble experimenting on all sorts of things. We're experimenting in rent control. We experiment on inclusionary zoning. We experiment on employer mandates. We experiment on all sorts of issues like that. But when it comes to things that might be pro-growth, pro-economic development, we seem to vapor lock. That's an observation, nothing more. Finally, and just very briefly, I have to speak to the comments made by Metro, but as Mr. Jillian has already mentioned, most of the land brought in was in Damascus, which just committed municipal suicide, so I have a hard time thinking of that as accurate count. And secondly, the fact that most of the land brought in by Metro is not yet developed should not be a surprise. It's a 20-year land supply. If that land immediately sprouted houses, that would mean we did not have a 20-year land supply. What they added should have been going into production in 10 to 15 to 20 years. That's the way the system is designed to work. To mention that the land hasn't developed yet as somehow an indication that it wasn't needed is nonsense. The end of rant. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to take questions.
Seeing no questions, thank you.
Thank you.
So considering who's left here, I think maybe we could actually move these bills.
No, I don't think so. Oh, I could. I would do that, too, yeah.
Oh, but I think we have only public hearings scheduled for today.
Oh, there's that. Thank you. Okay, next panel, Nathan Hovekamp, Thomas Mosher, Mary Kyle McCurdy, and then there's Mary Ann. If you could fit a fourth, we could just do them all. And then I was hoping just for some reaction from DLCD, if we have time for that. So if you could be quick. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's good to see you from Bend.
Thank you. Chair Dimbro, members of the committee, I am Nathan Hovekamp. I'm a wildlife program director for Central Oregon Land Watch. For more than 30 years, Land Watch has worked to protect what people love most about Central Oregon, our farms, our forests and high desert, our rivers and springs, our fish and wildlife, and well-designed communities. Land Watch plays a vital role in achieving a responsible, balanced approach to planning and conserving Central Oregon's land and water resources while recognizing the need for future generations. We work to protect and conserve the region's ecosystems and wildlife habitats, to foster thriving, sustainable communities, and to spread the costs and benefits of growth equitably across the community as a whole. Driving the six-hour round trip to be here and living and coming to know Eastern Oregon over the last 20 years, it doesn't break my heart to drive across that country. It swells my heart that we have had the foresight to protect that beautiful land. Just a few seconds, if I can, on these bills. Senate Bill 432, Land Watch understands the challenges that rural counties in Oregon face, but we do not believe that casting aside our statewide land use planning would alleviate those difficulties. Indeed, haphazard development on rural and agricultural lands would have expensive impacts on infrastructure and services in already struggling communities throughout the state. regards to Senate Bill 602. LandWatch certainly supports healthy, sustainable economic activity, but believes it's a false choice to do so at the expense of statewide land use goals. Indeed, we believe that the cumulative effects of Oregon's prescient protections of rural and agricultural lands are a primary reason for our attractiveness to individuals and businesses and a lead contributing factor to our standard of living. In regards briefly to Senate Bill 608, LandWatch supports the provision of needed housing within urban growth boundaries but does not support undermining the procedure for doing so under current statewide land use law. The methodical and systematic processes of lands inventory, needs analysis, and examination of alternatives continues to wisely guide the orderly development of our communities while protecting surrounding rural lands. In regards to Senate Bill 612, LandWatch supports the creation of good-paying jobs but believes it is a false choice to do so at the expense of statewide land use goals like, again, orderly land use planning and development, preservation of farm and forest lands, and protection of natural resources. Finally, in regards to Senate Bill 618, LandWatch strongly supports Oregon's landmark statewide land use planning goals and system and opposes attempts to regionalize or weaken these protections or to expedite sprawl. Local control, as a phrase, may have a nice ring to it. And with apologies to Garrison Keillor, we often feel our hometown is where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. However, the state of Oregon had the foresight to create a statewide system of land use planning that has largely resulted in our statewide appeal. In regard to the contention that exploding UGBs and facilitating sprawl will result in affordable housing, with apologies to H.L. Mencken, to every complex problem, there is a simple answer that's wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. Thomas.
Chair Demarest, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Mosier. I'm here. I have the pleasure to represent both Central Oregon Land Watch as well as the Audubon Society of Portland on this issue. As you just heard from Nathan, there's that. For the Audubon Society of Portland, specifically, we'd like to speak to 602, 612, and 618, which we just feel uses too broad of a brush to deal with what is a serious issue. As Nathan mentioned, this is something that, as a state, we came together to look at, and it really has a lot has done a lot to go to the desirability of the state as a whole, and to use such a as these bills use such a broad brush to make changes to this, it just seems dangerous for us. Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We oppose the five bills before you, mainly because they offer the false promise that if more land were available, economic development would occur. And not only is raw land very expensive to serve with infrastructure, but true economic development is more complex. And I will echo something Mr. Chandler said about it's time, something along the lines of it's time to stop taking timid steps and pilot projects and actually invest. And that means money and politically hard decisions in making the land that we do have available, actually available for more development. That's why land inside urban growth boundaries does cost more, because there's been public and private investment in pipes and roads and schools. Agriculture is the number one industry in much of rural Oregon, certainly in eastern Oregon, and it has been growing in every decade through every recession, exceeding the high-tech industry at times statewide during recessions. It has not decreased in value. In southeastern Oregon, there are almost 3,000 farms producing a market value of over $700 million and generating many more times that amount in local jobs and businesses. Malheur and Umatilla County are in the state's top five ag-producing counties. Malheur County is the United States' seventh largest beef producer. It's also agriculture is the largest jobs provider, employing over 20% of the population in Malheur County. Morrow and Umatilla counties together, agriculture and the investment in agriculture, long-term investment in irrigation infrastructure, is yielding onions, watermelons, and much more, and in collaboration with the Port of Morrow that has provided space for food processing, for ethanol businesses, things like that, it is growing, and Morrow County is Oregon's third most productive agriculture economy. Oregon's rural communities cannot afford to lose this industrial land base. It's not just vacant land waiting to be developed with other jobs or houses. And in fact, serving those houses will be more expensive than the producing lands that are currently in Oregon's agricultural industry. Instead, the state needs to invest in growing the existing agriculture-related businesses, improving the transportation needs of farming and ranching, and incentivizing value-added production. I wanted to talk about a couple of bills that passed in past sessions. Senate Bill 766, which together with some things that happened after it, have created regionally significant industrial areas and sites. Those were fast-tracked sites that are designated. They're on maps now by Business Oregon that are supposed to be shovel-ready, and they are shovel-ready for businesses to locate in them. Most of those are in rural Oregon. I don't know how many of them have been developed, but the state does have that program. I think most of them are actually being underutilized. In Ontario, for example, the Ontario UGB has actually an urban reserve that's over 1,000 acres, and they've been bringing land into the Ontario UGB steadily in the last few years. 115 acres were brought in for an agricultural processing plant. It's not clear that that's ever been developed. And just a few years ago, over 300 acres were brought into the Ontario UGB for industrial, residential, and public facilities and have been annexed. And in both those cases, that was from irrigated farmland. We lost really great farmland, but it's inside the Ontario urban growth boundary. If those haven't developed, I'd suggest it's because they need other investments in addition to the raw land. Thank you.
We're going to have to move on. Thank you. Marianne?
Chair Dembro, members of the members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash. Here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau, I will be very brief. At the Oregon Farm Bureau, we are very concerned about the health of our rural communities. Many of our members, and in fact most of our members, live and work in these communities. We want to find a way to attract new industry without harming existing industry, much of which is agriculture in these rural areas. This is a goal we share with many in this room, and understandably a difficult balance to strike. I just wanted to show the committee we've been speaking with Senator Ferrioli about these bills and are working with him to see if we can find a path to strike this balance in a way that will be protective of agriculture but ensure economic growth as well. So
that'll thank you. Great. Marianne, so are you suggesting that 432 is something that under some circumstances is deserving of a work session?
So, Chair Dembro, as presently drafted, we oppose all of these bills, but I think we've spoken with him kind of about, and he very eloquently said some of the issues he's trying to get at, and we're currently looking at some options that we think might strike a good balance, but don't have anything decisive yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.
So can we just very quickly get some reaction from DLCD? That would be great.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, Ellen Miller, legislative coordinator with DLCD. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. We're really here to provide information and answer questions about the conversations we just heard. We do recognize that the regions around Oregon are very unique, especially in eastern Oregon. Each region has different natural resources, different infrastructure, different challenges. We work with these regions through our six regional offices around the state. With me today is our community services specialist, John Jennings, out of our Bend office. I'd like for him to have an opportunity to respond to some of the conversation and talk about the work that he does out in eastern Oregon. Before I hand the mic to him, I want to respond to your questions about House Bill 4079. The rules and the application procedures were approved by our commission in January. We are in the process of putting our website together and information and our communications plan to get the information out to the eligible cities. The pre-application deadline, we believe, will be in late August, with the final application due early in 2018. Per the legislation, we are required to report back to the legislature by the end of this year, so you will likely get a report from us this fall on the progress of that. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to John.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. I'm John Jennings. I'm the Department's Community Services Specialist, as was mentioned. I work out of Bend, Oregon. I have been with the department for 20 years, and about 18 of them been over there. Kind of got a reputation as Eastern Oregon guy, for better or for worse. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us a chance to offer some of our thoughts. Again, there was, as was mentioned, we don't have any positions on these bills, but we do have some things that might be useful for the committee as it moves forward to make some choices. Again, I'd like to quote a great Oregon leader. As many of you know, Judge Steve Grassley, retired Harney County, and he would say that if you've seen one county in Oregon, you've seen one county in Oregon, right? Very good. So there's a lot of differences, but there's also some similarities. I've been traveling for many years and sat in the senior centers and city halls and county courthouses. People want to be successful. They want a fair shake. They want to have some self-determination. We think that we work very hard to see that all those are available to the folks we work with. One of the commonalities with many of the jurisdictions we've been talking about is sage-grouse. And I don't want to belabor that point. I know you've heard an awful lot about it, but I think it is important to just mention that one of the reasons, a primary reason, that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made their determination in 2010 that listing that species was warranted was an absence of adequate regulatory mechanisms. Now, we worked very hard for several years with a great group of people, diverse group of people, to come up with rules for, my commission adopted, and also Fish and Wildlife Commission, and with the help of other Western states, Oregon really anchored the ability for the service to determine that that listing was not warranted. And so we, through that work, we think we did a lot of the heavy lifting to see if that was not an endangered species, and a potential to roll back some of that. We worry, we think we'd be neglect and or remiss in not bringing up, kind of going against the tenants that led us there in the first place. So, as we work with our local jurisdictions, some of the things we don't do, we don't have direct decision making responsibilities in almost every case. That's with the local government; they make their own decisions. We do participate. We provide technical and financial assistance the best we can. Some examples, I guess, real quickly are with a project, and it was mentioned earlier in Malheur County, Treasure Valley Renewable Resources. Which would have been a great thing for that community, and we were very excited about it. We worked diligently with our stakeholders. It was appealed locally by local party, but that appeal was upheld. I think that was a good example of us working and trying to move that forward. More recently, in an instance where LCDC does have some approval denial making authority, there was a project. I'm pleased to say is a project ongoing in Lake County, the city of Lakeview. Red Rock is the name of it. It's a biorefinery that would be basically fuels out of biomass, a multi-$100 million investment and again, of all places, Lakeview, Oregon. We think it's a great opportunity, and in order to establish their entitlements, they need to expand their urban growth boundary. We worked with them to do that. Our participation through that process will allow us to turn around an approval very quickly, and after 4 days, I think 4 days of receiving the local decision, we issued an order acknowledging that UGB expansion. So again, we take the charge very seriously. We work very hard. We believe that there is a lot of unrecognized or unappreciated flexibility in the program as it stands right now, and we'd be just happy to do our best to answer any questions, and hope you'll draw upon us as a resource now and in the future.
Questions, colleagues? Yeah, I think not for now, but at some point I would like to get a better sense of why that last project that you talked about worked well, and why the earlier one that you mentioned, that was referenced earlier and then lost on appeal, where is it working, where is it
not? Yes, so I believe it prevailed on appeal, Senator Dimbrough. Chair Dimbrough. So, yes, we'd be happy to talk about that, and we'll perhaps schedule some other time. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes.
Not a question, just a statement.
Yes, please.
I mean, it's frustrating at times to be a rural, not for you guys, you know, but it's frustrating as a rural person to sit in these conversations and recognize that everybody's talking past each other and nobody's talking to each other, and it drives me crazy. We sit in Coos Bay and along the coast, and our people who have to work in our restaurants to serve the people that are coming over from the valley live in their cars because they can't afford a place. They are homeless. It's remarkably ridiculous. And they say how well our land use planning, and it's working well in the metro area. I mean, some of the best farmland in all of Oregon has now been paved over. And every time they want to expand, they do. They do it nicely. But what's the number one producing county in our deal? It's Clackamas County. And yet we're looking at, it drives many people on the coast crazy to hear people say the land use planning is working so well. And I think that there are places where it has really done well with these big populations. We don't have huge populations. We are not going to grow out of control. And having the expertise makes it really hard. And I listened to the conversations. I mean, in the planning, you've got to plan to make sure you've got your transit and all this kind of stuff. We don't have transit. I mean, you can't get from one place to the other in most of our areas. And so I understand in places where it's really important, and I wish we could eventually have a real conversation that talks about what is it that we need. Because I don't necessarily agree it's these bills. I don't think they're the panacea, but we haven't had much help. And there's very little recognition that the schools and the kids that were educated in the 1950s and 60s in the Portland and all the metropolitan areas were educated on timber money that we in the rural areas did for them. And now every once in a while I hear complaints that we're in the urban areas are making the money and we're sending it to the rural. That's true, but we would love to do real economic development in our areas and do some logging appropriately. Nobody wants to do it the way it was done before. But nobody that I know of really takes the time to talk to each other and listen to each other. And that's why this kind of hearing is frustrating to me. Just had to say that, get it off my chest, so I can get to my next meeting and be calmer.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I would, as the chair of this committee, welcome any suggestions for how we can enhance that kind of dialogue and analysis of the relationship between housing costs and land costs and right. The process. You know, I think the jury is still out about what is driving up the cost of housing and what's creating the lack of investment in housing. So, anyway, but we got to make
Another
way
time.
For
My committee.
Your committee. So,
I know.
With that, everyone, we are adjourned.